gonna turn it right down, there we go, to zero. And I'm now gonna put it right up to 10. Okay. I noticed you have two recruiting periods in the year, one in September and one in January. Why did you have that?
Well, that simply reflects the fact that I had earlier referred to the reallocation of quota from other universities. And what they did, if, for example, McGill had not filled its quota, that would become available to us, and we could recruit up to that to fill the program for the year. That's basically where that stems from.
Oh, I see. Wouldn't that create some disparity, though? The cadets who, registered in January and those who registered in September?
Well, they would have.
They would have missed, one
part of the training. That's not serious deficiency. Again, I had mentioned earlier that our training was not to any particularly fixed programs, so that we were not really disadvantaged by this.
Uh-huh.
Some of them couldn't march very well on a big fancy tri-service parade, but not the hell. Their hearts were in the right place.
Yeah. Would you sometimes perhaps take cadets on, maybe not officially, to pick up some training in, because you might think that probably there's going to be room for them in January?
We may have done that on an occasion, but by and large, no. It would be a demoralizing thing to create an expectation of that kind in case you couldn't or didn't fill it. But sometimes those who were very, very eager and not selected in the first round would hang around, and we certainly didn't we treated them nicely.
Yeah.
But that would be the way in which that might occur.
The Air Force squadron was distinct amongst the ABC ones because you had female members. What was the policy regarding that?
Well, it was instituted in 1952, I think, and it simply was that the, I suppose particularly the wartime experience of the Air Force with women had been extremely good, and they continued in the post-war fluctuations in the size of the Air Force to have some female members, obviously in nursing, and in our case in the Air Force in dietetics, and with the expansion which I referred around the time of the Korean War. This program was expanded again, and women were employed in, apart from a specialty like dietetics, generally in administration and supply work, administrative work. And sometimes when it emerged that way, we had one who did a lot of work in physical education because that was her major. But they were a great asset.
Mm-hmm. But they were on the same basis as the cadets in
yes.
Squadron 2. They weren't.
Yes, treated exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
Their initial training was, however, in the first few years, not conducted in the same location as the men. The first year we took women, the first group were, I think, totaled 50 from McGill, Toronto, UBC, and Alberta, as I recall it. They did their training at London, Ontario, which was then a base which also concerned with the training of air women, females, and was better designed for their accommodation. In the latter years of the Reserve Officer School program, however, the women trained in exactly the same place and in the same program with the men in the summer.
During the winter terms, did they have exactly the same
yes.
situation on parade nights?
Yes.
Also in the mess?
Yes.
How did women fit in, though? This is overwhelmingly a male
yeah,
organization.
very well. I can't speak for women, but I think they like men. So from that point of view, there was a source of happiness to them. And from our point of view, they were hardworking, industrious, anxious to do well, and did well. And they fitted in my view, perfectly with the all the traditions and everything else of the organization. Led to some cleaning up of language in certain situations, I suppose, which is a desirable thing anyhow.
Mm-hmm. How about your officer staff? How did you keep up your officer staff?
Well, I think I indicated to you earlier that as the cadets moved up in seniority and experience and training, they undertook a good deal of the of the work of organizing, particularly, let's say, drill and that sort of thing. But the unit, of course, operated pursuant to an establishment laid down by the DND. Initially, it was commanding officer, one commanding officer, squadron leader, one staff officer, reserve, flight lieutenant, one resident staff officer who would be regular force, and a clerk to run the orderly room, and that was the sort of establishment laid on. So any additional people we had, we did through our own resources. Mm-hmm. Later, the establishment was altered. It was raised to wing commander's position. I think we need to correspond with the fact that the CO of the COTC was a lieutenant colonel, and the Army couldn't go us one better. Two IC squadron leader and two flight lieutenants. In our case, one of those flight lieutenant positions was taken up, of course, by the officer at Victoria, then Victoria College, now Victoria University. And the other one I was able to fill over the years on a kind of rotating turnover basis with graduates of the scheme who in each case, it's not entirely coincidental, were law students. That is, they had completed Air Force Reserve Officer training at this university or more frequently another university and had graduated from it and then had come to do law studies here. And having known them during their training and so on, they was an ideal situation for them to, on the average, for 3 years, take on this this spare job, which we labeled training officer.
Mm-hmm. So your contacts, partly through the law faculty, you would have learned that here are some men who have experience.
Yeah.
So you just ask them to join.
Yeah.
Do you remember some names?
Sure. There's Mr. Norman Gish. Well, first Mark Sowell, who was a graduate of Royal Military College, and who's a lawyer downtown now, and that's M-A-R-C-S-O-U-L-E. And then there was Norman Gish, who's a lawyer, but with one of the big forest companies. He was a graduate of the scheme in Alberta and came here to law school. Another one, the last one I can think of at the moment is Fred Ray, who is spelled F-R-E-D-R-E-A-G-H. Fred Ray was a had served in the Air Force on a regular basis prior to coming to law school. And he had a short service commission and flew jets over in Europe and then came to law school. And I had the good fortune to know him, and I nailed him to be the training officer. And, mm-hmm. and I think all of them enjoyed it, and it was a modest supplement to their incomes. And in those
mm-hmm. ROTP started in 1952.
Yes, the same year as the ladies.
Mm-hmm. You would have had some ROTP cadets in the Air Squadron.
Yes, well, when ROTPs came ROTP scheme came in, forgive me, the a number of the fellows then in reserve, and particularly in reserve taking aircrew training, transferred across to ROTP. That is, they became then subsidized at the university. Mm-hmm. And that really was the initial group.
Yes. You mentioned now that also same year, 1952, Victoria College established a unit.
Yes.
Do you know why? Why that came about?
Well, there were two reasons. The COTC had a detachment there, and in a sense we were competing for people at that time. It was a time of Army expansion as well as Air Force expansion, and the Navy, of course, well, the local unit here didn't have a detachment there. There was a UNTD division at Victoria University operating out of the reserve establishment in Victoria. So we determined that we ought to expand in that way, and so we did.
How did they relate to you?
At Victoria?
Yes, so they were subordinate to the unit here.
Yeah, they were just a detachment of this squadron.
I see. Mm-hmm. You were commanding officer,
yes.
And
the
person in charge there would be like second in command.
Yeah. We used to just call him the officer in charge of Victoria. All the clerical administrative work, the ordering room work, was done out of the UBC office, of course, and so on.
Was there any other interaction as far as training?
We made a practice of bringing them over as many as we could, or it was convenient to do, for the tri-service parade and ball and occasions of that kind. Some would come too for things like the mess dinner, but primarily we, at least in the latter years, organized a situation whereby the three groups at Victoria, Army, Navy, and Air Force, would have a joint mess dinner. And a couple of occasions it was up at Esquimalt, and perhaps more frequently at the Work Point Barracks, the Queen's own regiment officers' mess. And the idea really behind that was because we wanted to, again as we did here, invite as guests the representatives of the educational institution in which we were functioning. So thus at the Victoria Mess Dinner, well, I would go 1 year perhaps and preside, because it was the Air Force's turn to be the duty service for tri-service matters. our guest would be, for example, at first the principal of Victoria College and later the president of the University of Victoria. And those people there who assisted us with a training program and lectures and so on. So it was made really a Victoria College occasion, even though these were, as far as the Army and we were concerned, detachments.
Mm-hmm. Did that fit in okay with your quotas too, the different categories and everything?
Well, we had to
carve
out of the total quota whatever we took in at Victoria. This made it very, very awkward later when when the quotas got so small, because you had to have enough people there to make it kind of viable.
Yeah.
And at the same time, we were getting damn near unviable here as a single unit. And then, of course, at the same time, in the latter years, they expanded again in the sense that we were we could recruit from Simon Fraser University when it started. And so there was a further dilution of viability, I call it, in terms of numbers.
Speaking of quotas, when did you first start to have your quotas reduced? There was like an expansion at the time of the Korean War.
Yes. Well, through 52, 53, 54, I would say the quota began to come in meaningfully in around 54. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's just my best recollection.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think
couldn't swear to that.
It coincides with what others have said. It, in the mid-50s anyway,
yeah.
It started. Why do you think that started it? Why do you think they started to lower the quotas?
Well, there were a number of reasons. The service was, as such, was preoccupied, of course, with manning its regular ranks. And consequently, the focus of their attention was on the ROTP. The reserve element had, from that point of view, not been as productive as they had hoped. In addition, I suppose one would just have to say simply a cost factor. They had, during this period, opened, of course, the Collège Militaire Royal de Saint-Jean for officer training, and they were operating, of course, Royal Roads and the Royal Military College. Their political masters, the Treasury Board, the providers of the funds for defense, would no doubt question the validity of expenditure on officer training that was, on its face, not productive in manning the ranks of the regular force. Yes. However much value we may have attached to it from a citizen education point of view. So I think for those kinds of reasons, economy,
they
began to limit the intake. They also, of course, as the expansion ceased and the service sort of settled in size to the extent that it did, then they had to have, of course, some consideration of the opportunities for useful summer employment for these people. And that would be a minor factor in fixing a number and deciding that would be it. Equally so, at the same time, they expanded the college scheme into Newfoundland and smaller maritime universities, and so that there was a dilution from that point of view, too. They were going to more sources for really less people. Mm-hmm. And hence, one can understand why the quota system was introduced.
Do you think that when ROTP was instituted, did anyone see this as kind of an indication that there might be changes? ROTP might be favored more, the sure source of recruitment?
Yes, I don't think there's any doubt about that. A lot of us questioned the validity of the scheme from again our own very narrow point of view. We all thought that probably a better way, from the university point of view, of doing it would be to encourage the individual to enroll in the reserve for the first year. Then the service could have a look at him, but equally important, the individual would get a good look at the service and he'd make an intelligent judgment about making a career of it, and your retention factor would probably be better. Mm-hmm. That was a bit idealistic, however, because part of the impulse for the program came from the education side in Canada. It was thought that not only would it be good for the service in getting people, but it might create the opportunity for young people to go to university who otherwise could not, for financial reasons, go. So there were the recruitment then really for a good proportion of these people was done outside the university and prior to university sort of starting. And people would arrive here, perhaps recruited in Saskatchewan, to be ROTP members of my squadron. And I'm not disparaging Saskatchewan, but one of the problems in that scheme as a national scheme and moving people around much according to their preference once the colleges were filled was that there's a wide variation in pre-university education across the country. That's perhaps less so now, but for example, Saskatchewan used to give a senior matriculation with 12 years of elapsed education. In BC, we wouldn't let them in until they had 13 years elapsed education. The Saskatchewan student could then get into applied science, for example, with a year less education for that technical reason than the local man, and he just wasn't competitive, and it was a very tough situation. Many of them suffered thereby. It's not to say that if they'd stayed in the Saskatchewan system and gone through it, that they wouldn't have ended up a perfectly good engineer, but it's just the timing of it was harmful to them, and discouraging. Well, these were problems that we conferred about from time to time manually and endeavored to rectify.
Did you ever take your idea to the authorities, the idea of why not start an ROTP for second year students instead of first year? Mm-hmm.
In a feature of the, I can't speak quite for the others, but I'm sure they had equivalent things, but we ended each reserve officer school session with an annual CO's conference, which would be attended usually by the chaired, but usually by the Air Officer Commanding Training Command and his staff officers from Air Force Headquarters who were concerned with the thing, and all the RSOs and COs and such other officers as might be available, and a very thorough review of previous experience and future plans took place at that time. Mm-hmm. So that, there was constant interchange. We would have annual visits from staff officers from Training Command and from Headquarters during the winter, again with a view to ironing out problems and exchanging views.
I see. Yes. Well,
the thing was taken very, very seriously by the RCAF, almost in a surprising way, the amount of attention paid to this form of officer training.
Yes. These annual CO meetings now, they would have become a real place for the interchange mm-hmm. of experiences. Having the COs from units across Canada, though, I wonder if you would have, it would have been kind of a good occasion too to kind of get together and if there was a difference, say, with the RCAF, the regular Air Force, this would be a chance to. I don't want to use the word lobby.
I know what you mean. Most of us certainly felt, and we were certainly treated, not as some different kind of animal or a mere reservist, but as full-bore members of the service for those purposes and times in which we were serving. It was a rewarding experience from that point of view, and our views were treated with the greatest of interest and deference too.
I wonder on, say, the quota issue. Has this been taken up at these meetings?
Oh, yeah. And then the answer was much as I have given it to you, uh-huh. that there are dictates of economics and so on producing that.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to ask you about the organization. Now, the Air Squadron, the University Air Squadron, was directly under the Headquarters Training Command.
Yes.
And this meant that you would have had parity with, say, the Sea Island base or any other Air Force base. Isn't that right?
Well, parity, in a sense. We were an independent unit, and we had our own quarters, and I was the CO of it. And in that sense, although, mind you, we were in a very narrow range of activity, so yes. You wouldn't compare it in that way. But in effect, my superior was the Air Officer Commanding Training Command. That is, there was no intermediate headquarters between me and him. For example, the COTC, I think, were responsible to, at least to some extent, to the local area commander, the district commander.
Mm-hmm. But say no, you had a request, of another base, the Sea Island base.
Mm-hmm.
Now, but you'd go through the headquarters, who in turn would,
yes,
at that level, take it back to Sea Island.
These bases were instructed from Air Force Headquarters to afford us as a unit certain services and facilities,
mm-hmm.
such as supply. But as far as that goes, we were always on good terms with the local people, even though they were in a different command. Real terms of friendship and social occasions and so mm-hmm. on. And we were, again, I emphasize, welcomed as though we were full-bore members of the service. And so these matters of medical services and so on, supply, pay, and these sorts of things were largely done on a buddy basis in a way, mm-hmm. although the legal structure underlay it, of course.
Yeah. In 1958, the units had a tri-service staff officer.
That's correct. Colonel, now Lieutenant Colonel, then Major Reynolds, yes.
What was the rationale behind setting this up?
Well, the Minister of National Defense of the day, Mr. Perks, looked around him and he saw a hell of a lot of regular force people being employed in what struck him as an activity that could well be supported by one officer instead of three. At UBC, for example, there was an Army Resident Staff Officer and a Navy Resident Staff Officer and an Air Force Resident Staff Officer and separate orderly rooms and clerks. And in his conception, which was not original or new, of the movement towards integration of the forces, this seemed to him to be a situation was ripe for economies as well. Mm-hmm. And accordingly, he determined that would take place, and it did. Mm-hmm. The difficulty with it was, of course, they are still different systems with different channels of command and different requirements, even though we're all engaged in the same business. There were even, I think, sorry.
How did the Tri-Service RSO work then? How did it work out?
Well, it really transpired that because of these differences that I've referred to, and because of our experience with the hours that the former individual officer seemed to be required to put in, that we were going to require assistance additional to that the one RSO could provide. So the local Air Force headquarters, again, this cooperation bit, sort of annotated one of their officers to devote a good proportion of his time to our affairs. So at that time, Flight Lieutenant McNichol, who is now Colonel McNichol and CO at Comox, besides doing his own work at the headquarters, which was in personnel, but where there were other people to help cover it off, came along to UBC and functioned much as the old RSO had done. Colonel Reynolds, of course, did operate to coordinate a lot of these activities and just did, in what must have been for him rather difficult circumstances, in my view, a splendid job. You know, he had to adjust his training and experience to some nuances, at any rate, of difference in system and organization and ideas, and he did that remarkably well.
Mm-hmm. Did that continue throughout, or was it?
No, it lasted about. Now my recollection's bad. I think 2 years, and then regular force staff officers were appointed for each unit again. The experiment didn't really work. We just found there was too much to do.
Yes. Yeah. In the 1958 commanding officer's report, in reference to this, so this would be your yeah. author, you'd be the author, I think, says, he is immediately responsible to the recently created director of ROTP.
Yes.
Is that the situation?
Yes. This emphasizes and serves to illustrate the increasing emphasis on ROTP. At headquarters, they had determined to appoint a senior officer to be oversee, in a sense, the whole ROTP business. And I think the first one was Brigadier Rothschild, as he then was, later Major General Rothschild. So it was a high-level appointment, and he sort of oversaw the ROTP side of things. Mm-hmm. Don't know that it was a highly effective structure. We were quite satisfied, at least I was, with how we were doing it. Mm-hmm. That is to say, total integration of reserve and regular, and same pattern of training and same treatment, and I thought this was a better method. Mm-hmm. And however, that was the case. Mm-hmm.
So say after the Second World War, usually referred to as the Cold War period, and mm-hmm. perhaps we can say that the Cold War has kind of undergone changes since this time. And I was wondering if you offhand can recall any changes that resulted from a different a foreign policy that Canada evolved over this time. For example, I would say during the Korean War, this is strongly a Cold War issue, although Canada was there under the UN auspices.
Yes.
Still that and treaty alliances. But later on, Canada started to get more involved in peacekeeping, which is something perhaps a little more neutral. And I wonder if...
Well, I would say that although that has been, of course, the emphasis of the last few years, and in fact the actual employment of a considerable portion of our defense personnel, that the commitments extant at, let's say, in the 50s are still with us. Canada is still a member of NATO and makes a now diminished but still saying a diminished but still substantial contribution on its NATO treaty commitments to maintaining a force in Europe and the North Atlantic. And the NORAD agreement still obtains, that is the North American Air Defense Agreement with the United States, whereby we provide a not a very considerable military clout input, but certainly have assumed a good deal of responsibility in that regard. Indeed, for many years, Air Marshal Slemon, of course, was the 2IC of NORAD in Denver, and he was really the continuing commander. The American chief would come and go, and he really assumed large responsibilities there, and he's been succeeded since then by senior Air Force officers as 2IC of NORAD, and the largest sub-headquarters of NORAD is, of course, is in Ontario at Sudbury.
I wonder.
So those commitments really continue, although our contribution to them has manifestly diminished. You can't run the service down from 180,000 to 80,000 and still make the same kind of waves.
Yeah. I was wondering, though, when, say, perhaps some of the lectures and things like that you had, if there would have been perhaps a room to express a philosophy of UN mm-hmm. orientation.
Yes, one of the things we tried to take advantage of, because there are people who are very knowledgeable in this area on the university staff, was to spread that light, as it were, to the cadets who might otherwise not be exposed to it. You know, to take a fellow doing applied science, he's pretty well wrapped up in labs and his engineering studies and so on. Well, it's good for him to come out on a Thursday evening and get a flop of something else, some insight into world politics and the organizations that are concerned with it and so on.
I'm going to digress a little bit. You refer to the organizations which Canada is involved in, NORAD, NATO. Now, NORAD is linked up with Defense of North America with the United States. I wonder how you feel personally if Canada was not, to some extent, becoming more submerged in the with the United States rather than having a more distinguished foreign policy?
Gosh, I don't know. In terms of actual sort of participation by American forces on Canadian soil, for example, manning some of the radar sites and so on, that has diminished, in fact, from what it was at one time when the threat of air attack on North America was considered to be, if not probable, quite possible. Today, I suppose one would say that kind of likelihood is considerably diminished, and we're into this age of intercontinental missiles. Should mm-hmm. there be any very serious difference of opinion? But we are, you know, after all, we can allies between Russia and the United States. If you look at the globe, and we're I suppose a species of, if you like, buffer zone between the two, geographically, and certainly our interests are much more easily identified as being alongside or analogous to or along with those of the United States than they are of the Russian Empire. So that for both cultural and practical political reasons, I see a good deal of correlation between foreign policy of the two countries. We're a very minor figure in terms of particularly, I suppose, of numbers of people, although I don't back off from anybody in saying that we can haul our weight and more than do so, and have done so demonstrably in history.
Don't you think this close involvement, though, might result in a loss of some identity, some sense of distinction?
Well, I suppose it does. Canada's kind of a curious country, you know. It was sort of hung together with some fairly improbable and disparate groups by Sir John A. primarily. It tended, because of being overshadowed by the enormous power to the south, to identify very strongly with England, with Britain,
yes,
and the institutions that we derived from England, the mm-hmm. parliamentary system, the idea of a sovereign, and there was a damn near, I suppose, almost a hysterically pro-British attitude. I think largely explicable in terms of anxiety about the overwhelming power, both economically and culturally and every other way, lying to the south of us. Of course, since then, there was a great deal of Canadian self-confidence. Curiously, I think, maybe unfortunately, but that's the way these things happen, identified with the efforts in two world wars. People often speak, and I think quite meaningfully, of Canada being born at Vimy Ridge in World War I, where there was a sense of pride of achievement, I suppose, in horrendous circumstances developed during World War I, and equally in World War II, the country made an enormous contribution. You know, Canada had the third largest navy in the world at one point in World War II, in terms of numbers involved. You know, it's an extraordinary thing to say, an extraordinary effort for such a small population, and your corresponding effort in the air and at sea. I suppose the comparable group, perhaps they did even more in those same terms, would be Australia.
How did you stand on, let's take one issue up, 1962, the Cuban crisis. Now, President Kennedy of the United States requested this the day before, the evening before he declared his quarantine. He said he wanted permission to fly missiles over Canada. And John Diefenbaker, Prime Minister at the time, refused at first, or he said, well, I have to consult.
Yeah.
Did you think?
I didn't really know any of those details. I knew in a vague way that Mr. Diefenbaker had kind of waffled, as it were, at the time of that crisis to, I suppose, the apprehension, as much as anything, of our neighbors. But I think it's an awfully significant fact that they took the trouble to consult or ask him.
Yes. But it did kind of capitalize the issue of, in the name of defense, would Canada perhaps have to not expect total sovereignty? Of course, I guess we do that anyway in treaties. But
well, we, as I've indicated before, Canada never really has been sort of sovereign in the sense that the United States, for example, could afford to be. We were always part of, first of all, the British Empire and part of the British Commonwealth. We relied, in a sense, on the Royal Navy, financed by England, for many years to be our principal means of defense. We didn't, I don't think there was ever any serious contemplation since the Fenian raids of anything like a warlike struggle with the United States. It's just, it's not there. So that we've, to some extent, always indulged ourselves in going along with somebody else's foreign policy. Mm. And in today's world, of course, it's an increasingly ineffectual gesture to attempt to do so. The whole world situation is one of checks and balances and alliances and gives and takes and so on. But, within that framework, we see latterly an increasing emphasis on serving what appear to be our own immediate interests, I suppose.
Yes. Canada today, of course, is in possession of vast territory in the north and the Arctic.
Yeah.
Possible to foresee that this might not, Canada may not be able to say hands off, this is completely ours, if there are vast discoveries of oil or something like that.
Oh, I have little doubt that we have sovereignty over the Arctic islands and that it is recognized. Particularly these contemporary moves to extend control over coastal areas and waters. This is a source of controversy right now, but I think it's coming in terms of conservation, if nothing else. So we'd see an expanded sort of sovereignty in that sense, too.
Yes, as you know, a couple of years ago, the United States did send a ship through that to test the viability of shipping in the area. There was seemed to be a little bit of conflict with the Canadian
authorities. Well, there is some significance to the fact that it was escorted by a Canadian icebreaker, as much as anything, an assertion of that sovereignty.
If I remember right, Canada had to offer to escort the.
Well, I really don't know the details, but I think it was significant.
Yeah, I as I say, if I remember right, that's what I recall. It'd be a point worth looking into.
Yeah.
So we'll return to.
Well, the United States, of course, has always been very strong on freedom of the seas and shipping. It's a considerable maritime nation, and goes back in their roots too, as was the case with Britain, of course, and it's. I don't doubt that they find it intensely irritating, for example, to have their tuna boats picked up 100-some-odd miles out to sea off the coast of Peru and arrested, but they seem to have learned to live with that, so perhaps that's a sign of the way things are going, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll turn to UBC. 1950, it seems to be quite an eventful year. I have another fact. Aircrew training was removed from your syllabus. I wonder, do you know why that came about?
Yes. Oh, we actually have discussed it earlier, but yeah. I can repeat it. Really, three factors, they're not unrelated, they're very much related. The introduction of all-through jet training for wing standard, the costs of providing it, and the inefficiency of providing it on an interrupted basis.
Nice.
Coupled with that, I think a decision to downgrade the plans for the Auxiliary Reserve Air Force, which we saw come to a head in the closing of the 19 wing at Sea Island and so on in several years' time.
Yes. What did the effect of these have upon your unit then?
Well, it was extremely serious. I was very upset. I argued like hell that they should at least finish off the guys we had in the stream to wing standard, because this is a tremendously important thing to a young man to get that badge of achievement. And that they could finish them off to wing standard on the old basis, that is, on the Harvard, they could move to the Auxiliary and so on, and that there was no reason to make an abrupt change of that nature. That dealt with the existing people, and I didn't succeed in either of those arguments. In fact, one of the fellows that was involved in that was a chap called Jack Henwood, who was pretty well known around UBC, quarterbacked the football team in the only reasonably successful year it ever had, and a real spunky little character. When they cut him, pinched off his flying training as it was approaching completion, he applied to transfer to ROTP, and he was quite ineligible on all accounts we normally think of. He was too old, he was married, he was in commerce, that wasn't too serious, but, you know, not an engineer, not this or that, and so a staff officer came out from Ottawa, and I had Mr. Henwood in to see him. I said, why not? And the staff officer said, why not indeed? Got to go. Okay, no more than half trained. So they bent all the rules, and he went into the regular force. Some of the others were enabled to complete their flying training by transfer to the auxiliary, going short service and so on. It was a very, very painful time for all of us. The other effect or consequence, of course, of the elimination of aircrew training was that you lost what were, in my view, the ideal attraction for getting the very best recruits.
Yes.
And after all, it is a flying service, and everything should focus around that. And although there are all kinds of jobs to be done in engineering and administration and supply and all these things, nonetheless, the heart of the thing is flying.
Yeah. Did that result in any difficulty in filling quotas?
Not really, no. The quotas also were getting so damn diminished, or starting to diminish by then, that it really wasn't a problem.
Yeah.
I just don't think we got the same quality that we did in reserve, at any rate. The flying was still available for the ROTP man.
Yes. Yeah. How would you describe your relationship with the COTC and the UNTD?
Excellent.
What do you mean excellent?
Better than excellent. Great. For a variety of reasons, not necessarily in order of importance either, we had firstly identification of the commanding officers with their profession. We were all university professors in the same university.
Yeah.
You start off with that. In the earlier part, of course, the CODC trained downtown, but the Army and Air Force shared the armories. The CODC maintained, the Navy maintained offices there, as all three did. And the Army and Air Force, of course, shared the mess. And in the latter years, the Navy were brought into it. Mm-hmm. Before I came to the unit, they'd already had a two tri-service parades and balls, which were the melding of the units for a ceremonial and social occasion. And that, of course, continued. And this created quite a bond and some healthy rivalry as well, you know. And
can you specify some of the competition, a rivalry? Better word.
Oh, it'd be childish in a way, but sort of things like, for example, I was I'd done quite a lot of drill work in my time, one way or the other, and fancied myself as being pretty good at it. I never ever had a cadet faint on parade, because I used to tell them how not to, and quite frequently the Army did. Well, this was a useful point to make a snide remark to your troops or them, and, you know, like we're better than they are in a way, that sort of thing, a healthy rivalry. We also had, of course, an annual sort of sports night with all three units in which we engaged in healthy rivalry of that kind, a wide range of activities. And ending up with a beer fight and that sort of thing. Then each unit put on a mess dinner annually to which the COs and certain representatives of the other were invited. And we cross-fertilized in that
That'd be
sense.
Three mess dinners a year, you mean?
Yep. And in addition, we'd have open to all, but primarily would be Army and Air Force again. We'd have a regular matter, New Year's Eve dance in the mess, some other social occasions, sometimes movies, and this sort of thing. So there was a good deal of mixing up, and we all, the Victoria thing pulled things together too, that I described to you. I think there was a great deal of mutual respect. For example, the Navy, in the early years at any rate, would bring over a DE to take prospective recruits for the UNTD for a ride up Howe Sound and around and a little exercise and so on board a ship. But invariably, my staff officers in the Army would be invited, and invariably we'd go, and we'd have a hell of a good time, and we'd learn something about the Navy, too. Mm-hmm. So that there was a good deal of that kind of cross-fertilization.
Yeah.
Frequently I was invited to sit on Navy selection boards, and would try to do so when I could, and this helped with an appreciation of each other's programs and so on.
Each year you would take turns organizing the tri-service parade. So this is called duty service.
Yeah.
What was involved in that?
Well, quite a lot, as a matter of fact. It involved, I suppose, first of all, finding an appropriate date, which would be constrained by the end of training on one hand and exams coming up on the other, and doing it well in advance in order to get the Lieutenant Governor to have the Lieutenant Governor available to come, tying it back with wherever you're going to hold it. For many years we held it at Discovery. It was only the last few years that we held it right out here in our own armories, and we had a kind of a floor on there that would serve the purpose. And casting up your invitation list, who are you going to invite, what's the cost going to be, who's the caterer, how do you decorate the place, then you have to get the band. All these things have to be booked well in advance, or they're just not available. There's a great deal of planning and effort goes into that kind of thing. And then, bars and bar fire service and, as I mentioned, the food and setting up before and cleaning up after are major facets of an enterprise of that kind, particularly when you're borrowing somebody else's place, as in the case of Discovery.
Mm-hmm. Would the different services ever do it in a different way? Like, would you introduce perhaps Air Force traditions in some way, or was there ever a basis for a kind of rivalry in this, outdoing the person or anything like that?
Well, I think everybody, no, that pretty well fell into a pattern. It's constrained by the nature of the event. A ceremonial parade is a ceremonial parade, and each year, of course, the cadet commander of that parade would come from the duty service, and they'd have to select the kind of an outstanding fellow with a cool head to run this thing. It's quite a chore to command a parade, particularly a ceremonial one. There's things to remember to do in the right order, get people back where they started from, and so on. And in a narrow place like the Armies, or a small place like the Armies, it was quite a feat to run an efficient and impressive parade. But we had good luck all the time with them.
Would you be involved in the organization of the duty service too?
Oh yeah. If you were duty service, you carry the can. That's called responsibility. Yeah, I can delegate it around. But you have to see the things are done.
The reason I thought there might be a difference, though, is because in the case of the Navy, they had a different mess set up. Senior officer,
gunroom ordnance set up. Yeah, it was a different setup, and it goes back to ancient naval tradition where midshipmen and were messed in what they called a wardroom, or a gunroom, and the officers, of course, in the wardroom. No, we had no such distinction out here, and indeed in the... It worked out the same way. In our services, of course, we considered that once the kid was an officer cadet, well, that was part of his training, was mess etiquette, mess life, and participating fully in it. And we never drew a distinction. On the other hand, the Navy group were very much ran their own show. So they maybe even got a more valuable experience in that sense. I can't estimate it. We had a cadet PMC and mess committee and so on out here, of course, but it was largely Army oriented. It was their mess and we joined it, although we maybe outnumbered them from time to time. I was always very careful, frankly, to leave it Army administered, even though I might differ in some senses in my service from the way they do those sorts of things, because if you start making too many waves, you may get the job. And I always thought, well, better go along with them than get saddled with it. But they tended to run to much closer supervision by a staff officer, one of the majors, than I would have done, or the Navy did, I think. But that's, by the way.
One last question on that, if you can answer it. How would you describe the mood of the tri-service parade night?
Usually,
of course, to the annual
event. Yeah, usually pretty good. It was quite an imposition on the cadets who were engaged in their studies and exams are looming up and so on. We'd lay on some, of course, extra drill and a rehearsal the night before with the band, and it would look awful usually, and then the next day they'd lay it on for you, They were wonderful. I think they took a very real pride in the accomplishment. You could sense that. They felt, I think, honored by the occasion, being dignified by the Lieutenant Governor coming, and the University President, and the Chancellor, and a large stash of guests, and they'd get through that damn parade, and it would all have gone all right. And we also had the Lieutenant Governor present them the senior ones, their commission scrolls, which marked the occasion in a very fitting way. And then there'd be the tea party afterwards upstairs in the mess, and people would chat and drift around, and the medals would clank. And very, 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 very good occasions, very gratifying occasions. Mm-hmm. And then followed by the party in the evening, which was usually a success. We never, one other thing about it I always thought was interesting, when we first started there, there was very, except on special occasions, there would be no bar or liquor facilities. And I instituted the idea of having beer after parade night. And we stretched that to wine with supper, and then we ultimately ended up with the full thing. But again, this was part of education and responsibility, too. We never had a traffic accident out of here, and they treated it with respect. And again, it was a good, far better to have them having a drink and conversation and whatever in the in the mess than zopping off and parade down to some local beer parlor. I thought.
Yeah.
It was guilty.
This bar that was set up, was that eventually a weekly? Open every week then, or?
Well, eventually built right in, and it was open whenever the place was open. Well, not at noons or anything like that, but on any parade night. Or
were you personally responsible for most for that coming about?
Well, I was one of the pushers, I think. Yeah, if you can put it that way.
I guess it was.
You know, you're sure they're some of them are young and underage, 17, 18, something like that, and. But what the hell? I was 17 or 18 once, and I know what one's propensities and inclinations are, and it was better to do it that way than some other way. Anyhow, the proof of the pudding's in the eating. It worked. I recall that when I first mooted the idea of holding the tri-service ball in the armories, one of my cohorts, fellow CEO, said, "Oh my God, what about the bar and stuff? We'd get raided by the Mounted Police, or we might. We're going to run it downstairs, you see."
Sure.
I said, "Well, how do you can let a DRO and just extend the mess to cover the whole armories? They're licensed." And I'll fix the Mounted Policeman. So I went over and saw the Mounted Policeman and invited him and his wife to come. And he graced the occasion in his beautiful red coat and had a wonderful time. We became good friends with him. So we didn't run into any problems. And he quite agreed with me that it was better a controlled, formal party of that kind than the kind of thing he frequently had in the
room. Being
kind of funny incident.
Legal. Would it be legal for a cadet under 21 to drink?
No.
It wasn't. Even though it was a
federal establishment?
Yes.
No, I this is always
on board a ship, a person under 21 could.
Well, sure, but nobody could catch him, but and he's at sea anyhow. But this has been discussed from time to time by various legal luminaries. But I'm reasonably satisfied that the provincial liquor laws prevail throughout the province, even though you may have a federal establishment, because we had a provincial license for the mess.
Yeah, I guess it was the 1964.
We also had the Attorney General of D.C. as an ex-CO, which may have helped, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I guess the year 1964-65 was the first year that you would have had the Navy unit on campus, and...
Yeah, my recollection...
Is that six? I'm going to just a sound turn right down.